Welcome back. It's another podcast brought to you by the Marx Engels Lenin Institute. And today I'm joined by Dermot Hudson to talk about the ongoing stories regarding the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and to bust up some of the myths that get perpetuated by the BBC and other bourgeois media outlets in Britain and, of course, across the world. And Dermot has joined us before, a couple of years ago, actually, so long ago it was pre-pandemic. So, Dermot Hudson, welcome back to the program.
Right. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a great honour to be here.
Now, Dermot, you're a representative of the Korean Friendship Association, and I wanted to give you an opportunity before we get into the discussion of DPRK-related issues, just to talk about this organization, what you do, and how people can find out more about it and get involved with it.
Okay, yeah. I'm the head of the UK branch of the Korean Friendship Association, which is a worldwide organization. We've got members in many countries. It was founded in November 2000 by Alejandro Caudebenos in Spain. And since then, it's expanded quite a lot. We've obviously got the our branch here in the UK. We've got a branch in the USA, in Germany, Italy, Croatia, Turkey, many other countries. And our core purpose, our mission, is to defend the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And as we say, we defend people's Korea with no ifs or buts. And, you know, we've existed in the UK for, well, virtually 22 years now. We carry out a number of activities to defend the DPRK. Recently, to mark the 73rd anniversary of the provocation of the Korean War by the US imperialists and South Korean puppets, we picketed both the US embassy and the South Korean puppet embassy on the same day. And we also held an anti-US live stream, an online event. So that gives you some idea of our activities. We hold different meetings, a lot of them online, some of them in real life. This year we've had meetings in London. We had quite a good one up in Liverpool. And we're hoping to organise other meetings in the Northwest and possibly in the Midlands and elsewhere. So I think that probably gives you a fair overview of what we do and who we are.
Well, thanks for that, Dermot. And I think the key phrase you used there is defending the DPRK with no ifs and no buts and no equivocations, because that's something that is actually quite rare in the rather, shall we say, shallow world of the British left. Every time the bourgeois go on the attack against a socialist country or just a country that has defied US imperialism in some way or another, there's always a thousand equivocations. So can you just talk a little bit about why it's so important that communists, Marxists, anti-imperialists must defend the DPRK without any equivocation?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, first of all, if you're a socialist or communist or Marxist-Leninist, it's a question of defending a socialist country, a country that's upholding socialist principles. And, you know, we have to remember that there were many countries in the world that betrayed socialism, hauled down the red flag of socialism, but the DPRK is upholding it. It's building socialism, not in ideal conditions, but in conditions of intense struggle against US and world imperialism. You know, it's under sanctions by the US and UN. And, you know, it deserves our total solidarity. And I think, you know, anything less is basically capitulating to the imperialists and the class hegemony. It's also the most independent country in the world. And in fact, John Major, during the Brexit referendum, he paid a very backhanded compliment to the DPRK when he said, "Oh, if you want to see a country with undiluted sovereignty, then it's North Korea." And of course, this was meant as an attack on the DPRK and also an attack on people supporting Leave. But in fact, it was basically, contained a big grain of truth. The DPRK is an independent country with its own ideology, its own system. And I think it's very important for socialists and communists, and indeed anyone standing against the US imperialism, to defend it. And it's a state on the front line between imperialism and socialism. And this year, you've had Sleepy Joe Biden talking about, he'll end the DPRK's existence. And that, of course, is a very real threat. The US is openly sending nuclear-armed submarines into South Korea, and there are war exercises being conducted all the time. So it's a frontline state, and if you don't defend it, you're basically giving in to the other side. And I don't think there is any space for people to sort of take the position of, oh well, we support this but we don't like this, and all sorts of things. As you've said, I think it's an issue that there is a lot of capitulation to bourgeois and imperialist propaganda on.
Yes, and one of the moments I identify as a trajectory in my own political evolution, Dermot, is when I was a member of a certain Trotskyite organization in this country, there was a congress they held in 2014 where one comrade tried to move a motion saying that there should be a discussion of the nature of the DPRK. And the motion was blocked by the leaders of that party on the grounds that it couldn't be discussed. They wouldn't even countenance a discussion of the DPRK. And so that was what led some of us in the end out of that party, because if you won't even consider what the lessons that can be learned from a socialist country that has survived a state of siege by imperialism for decades, then clearly you're not serious about actually applying the method of Marxism, to my mind.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And it is unfortunately true. There's several parties on the British left that take that stance, that, they cannot discuss the DPRK, they cannot support it. It's something, beyond the pale. It's something they cannot discuss. That position is taken by more than one party. And it's quite damaging, but at the same time, I think it also says a lot about the British left.
Yes, none of it good. Now, recently, Dermot, turning to some of the myths that the bourgeois do propagate, and unfortunately, which some of the left parrot, you had a letter published in the Morning Star, I believe, contesting some of these. Because the BBC were running again stories that are clearly false, but it'd be good for you if you could talk about this, about how everybody in the DPRK or large numbers of people are on the brink of or in the middle of starvation. It seems that these stories about the DPRK are run in the capitalist press around about every couple of years or so. Usually, it seems to me, before the US imperialists stage some kind of provocation. But can you talk a little bit about that and why it is you think that these stories keep being run by the imperialist press?
Right. I think you're absolutely correct that it these kind of stories do coincide with the actual US threats and exercises against the DPRK. You know, it's part of a massive and industrial scale propaganda campaign against the DPRK. And if you look at the recent BBC report, which, you know, was flagged up quite a lot in the mainstream media, you know, it was repeated by the press, it was repeated a lot on the internet. You know, there's several things you need to sort of look at. I mean, first of all, you know, as I pointed out in the letter to the Morning Star and to the Class Consciousness Project and a number of other outlets, BBC doesn't actually have reporters in the DPRK, and at present the borders of the DPRK are still shut, so you know they don't have any access to the DPRK. And what they claim to have done is to have used a South Korean propaganda outlet, the Daily NK, which is a notorious outlet, you know, well known for making up false stories about the DPRK. And what they've done is they've actually used them for their story. And the story, when you look at it in the cold light of day, doesn't ring true. It's, you know, based on, you know, third-hand reports where someone has said, you know, their neighbours starved to death. So, you know, you should ask the question, why did the neighbours starve to death? And, you know, not the sort, these people who are the source of the story. You know, surely if they're neighbours, they'd be very much in the same situation, same amounts of food, etc. You know, it's complete rubbish. And it's like, you know, all the stories that are coming out of the Daily NK, total rubbish. But what's different is that the BBC, which we call the British Brainwashing Corporation, which is like a major media player, whether we like it or not, you know, it's got sort of worldwide influence, decided to sort of broadcast this nonsense. And, you know, the basic purpose is to totally demonise the DPRK, to make it, you know, an easy target for a military attack. Because I noticed, you know, so, with some of the sort of spin-off articles that came from the BBC report, people saying, oh, the only thing we can do is to invade the DPRK, you know, so-called humanitarian intervention, which has been used by imperialism in the sort of past three decades. So it's aiming to sort of create a climate for that. And, you know, it's also, you know, it's the denigration of an alternative system. You know, it's trying to say to people, oh, you know, there's no alternative to the system we live under. You know, anything else is absolutely terrible. You know, just think you're, you know, the idea, or just think yourselves lucky, do as you're told, you know, you could be in a much worse situation, sort of thing. So, you know, that's basically the BBC story in a nutshell.
Yes, and it's important what you said there about the demonization of any possible alternative system. And particularly when it comes to the DPRK, which is a smaller country than Russia or China, and it therefore is easier to demonize in some ways, because most people will have not been there. They will not know anything about its system. And the more ignorant somebody is of something, the easier it is to convince them of something about that particular country. But I think the key point to touch on here is that the DPRK system is a genuinely different a system to capitalism. It is still, as far as I'm aware, correct me if I'm wrong, run on the basis of a planned economy. It's still a country which is run via the kind of its own unique system, but one inspired by the socialist revolutionary systems of the early to middle 20th century. And it hasn't gone down the line of marketization of its economy, which makes it an even bigger target for imperialism. So could you talk about like the DPRK system, the planned economy they have there, and why this makes it such a huge target of US imperialism?
Yeah, as you say, the DPRK economy is a socialist planned economy. There is social ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange. And this is codified in the constitution of the DPRK. And at the 8th Party Congress of the Workers' Party of Korea in January 2021, it was laid down very strongly that the DPRK is a planned economy. It was decided to strengthen economic planning and at the same time to step up the offensive against anti-socialist and non-socialist practices and ideas in the DPRK. And of course, this grieves the imperialists quite a lot because, they want to force capitalism on all countries, as you say, this makes the DPRK a target. And I suspect they inwardly, they feel a lot of frustration and anger that the DPRK is not reforming and opening up and that it's committed to socialism. It's not a member of the IMF or the World Bank or WTO. Mm. And this is, I'm sure, a source of great angst for them. They'd like to force the DPRK to change. And I think in today's world, it is also, the socialist country that I think most people is most identifiable as a socialist country, because it has a planned economy and because, everything is socially owned. I think I read somewhere, it might have been in The Guardian or something like that, they see the DPRK as, sort of left over from an era when you had a sort of socialist camp, in the days of Stalin and Mao. They see this as something quite unacceptable and something, they've got to try their hardest to knock down, whether by sanctions, whether by military threats, or by a sort of very intense propaganda campaign and an ideological campaign.
Yes, and it's important to emphasise, isn't it, that the DPRK has been subject to all of this hybrid warfare that you're describing there for many, many decades now, and that this is intensified following the collapse of revisionism in the USSR and the people's democracies. And the DPRK actually lost some key trading relationships at that time. But the fact that the revolutionary process in the DPRK has survived and continues should be reviewed as a remarkable achievement by everybody on the left who regards themselves as somebody who seriously seeks to overturn the current system. Because what you've got is a country that has been under siege for now over three decades, having lost some of its key allies, and yet continues to advance in terms of its development of its economy, development of its national culture. So can you talk a little bit, Dermot, about why it was that the DPRK was able to survive this catastrophe that went on in the late 80s and early 90s, whereas so many other countries, including the USSR, the place of the October Revolution itself, fell apart or imploded or were destroyed by, well, their own leaders.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, your last sort of few words, I think, are very important. You know, that countries like the USSR and a few others, they were actually betrayed by their leaders, whereas the DPRK was founded and led by great revolutionary leader President Kim Il-sung, and his work was taken over by Chairman Kim Jong-il. And the DPRK developed its own ideology, the Duce idea, which gave them an immunity to the revisionism that was sweeping across the socialist world. And of course, revisionism didn't just start in the 1980s. I think it goes right back to the 1950s. And at the time, the Workers' Party of Korea, led by President Kim Il-sung, was one of the parties that took a stand against modern revisionism. That is one very important factor, perhaps the most important factor. Secondly, the DPRK had developed an independent economy, you know, according to the Duce idea, and based on self-reliance. Again, that wasn't something new. Even in the early days, when they were building a new state in the 1940s, President Kim Il-sung referred to economic independence. And later, the Soviet Union formed the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, or COMECON, which at the time, you know, some people saw as the best thing since sliced bread. You know, an economic community for the socialist camp, you know, bit like the EU for the capitalist countries. However, the DPRK was pressured to join it, but decided not to, and instead put forward the line of building an independent national economy. And I read how Khrushchev said to President Kim Il-sung, "Oh, we can supply you with electric power. You know, you don't have to bother building power stations." To which President Kim Il-sung said, "Well, if we disagree with you, then you will turn the power off and we will be left in darkness." So, you know, the DPRK built up this strong independent economic potential. So it was able to withstand some of the shocks that occurred in the early 1990s. And also at the same time, it also mounted its own ideological offensive to defend socialism. It also took international initiatives such as the Pyongyang Declaration, Declaration of Communist and Workers' Parties, to defend socialism. So I think, you know, all these factors meant that the DPRK was able to uphold socialism despite the anti-socialist onslaught that occurred in those days.
Right, and just a supplementary question there, Dermot. The Pyongyang Declaration, was that in the 1990s that they made that?
Yeah, it was April 1992, and basically a number of communist leaders had travelled to Pyongyang for the celebrations of the 80th anniversary of the birth of President Kim Il-sung, and a number of party leaders signed the declaration then.
Right. Okay. So a bold and necessary statement when things were falling apart all over the rest of the world. And the 1990s were obviously a very difficult time to be a communist anywhere, but to lead a socialist revolution in a revolutionary process in a workers' state is particularly difficult. So to get through that time when there must have been, and indeed there was, an enormous amount of pressure coming from the imperialists to restore capitalism, to engage in so-called market reform. And yet the DPRK, for all the threats and the attempted bribery of the Clinton administration, because correct me if I'm wrong, Dermot, I believe it was at this time that there were negotiations between the DPRK leadership and the Clinton administration. But this, of course, led nowhere because the US imperialists were insisting on various unacceptable things, of course. So how is it that they were out that the DPRK survives that enormously difficult period and the threats of the imperialists that were coming in thick and fast at that time and held firm throughout that difficult decade of the 90s?
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, first of all, just quickly on the issue of the DPRK US negotiations. Yes, these happened because the US first tried to put pressure on the DPRK over the nuclear issue. But the DPRK took a very strong stand, and the Korean Peninsula was on the brink of war by 1994. So the US actually came out with negotiations. As you say, they went nowhere because the US failed to keep their side of the agreement. There was actually a DPRK US agreed framework, but it went nowhere, and it was eventually negated when Bush got into power in the early 2000s. And this was an incredibly difficult period for the DPRK. President Kim Il-sung passed away in 1994, and Chairman Kim Jong-il took over the reins of leadership. He declared very firmly, "Expect no change from me," because the expectation from the imperialists was that the DPRK was going to go down the road of reform and opening up. And as you say, this was an incredibly difficult period for the DPRK. It is known as the Arduous March in the DPRK because this was a period in which not only did the DPRK lose some external markets, the World Socialist Market disappeared, and they also had to face sanctions. But at the same time, there were a number of natural disasters, which created a very difficult situation. But Chairman Kim Jong-il rallied the people under the banner of self-reliance. He encouraged people to learn from Jiaxing province in the far north of the DPRK, where the people fought against the difficulties in the spirit of self-reliance. And this became a model for the rest of the country. And the Arduous March and Forced March were concluded by the year 2000. And this period, despite the pressure of the imperialists and the very difficult situation, this was a period which saw important achievements like the launch of the DPRK's first artificial satellite in August 1998. Just to give one example, and you had the construction of power stations and motorways. I was actually there in the DPRK in 1996.
Well, the crucial thing that you touched on there, Dema, is The involvement of the masses in the running of the country, because I think that this is something which not many people fully understand when it comes to a country like the DPRK, which is that the involvement of the mass of the working class and peasantry back in the day in the building of the system there, but also rallying to it and mobilizing en masse when difficulties are faced to overcome them. This is a crucial thing to understand, as far as I know, when it comes to the DPRK, that without that involvement of the masses and support of the masses for what they see as their system and their country, then the system couldn't survive, because it's only through the unleashing of the constructive energy of the masses that a socialist system like the DPRK can really move forward. So can you talk a little bit about that, the involvement of the masses and the support for the system in the DPRK that does exist within the population?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a fundamental aspect of the DPRK, and it is something that permeates all lines and policies in the DPRK. And back in the 1950s, when the DPRK faced a very difficult situation, when great power chauvinists and revisionists tried to overthrow the leadership, and you had the South Korean puppets and the US imperialists trying to invade the DPRK, and you had incidents like the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and like the Hungarian counter-revolution. The DPRK faced an intensely difficult position, and President Kim Il-sung said, we can only rely on the people. And he went to a steelworks on the west coast of the DPRK, the Gangsan Steelworks, and explained the situation to steelworkers there and said, we can only rely on you, on the Korean working class, no one else. And he appealed to them to produce more steel, and they actually doubled steel production. And DPRK is very much based on the mass line. You have in the DPRK the Chongsun Ri method and Chongsun Ri spirit, which you know, take their name from the place Chongsun, which is a farm in the DPRK, where President Kim Il-sung actually went and stayed for 15 days, you know, working with the ordinary people, mixing with the ordinary people. And he created this method of work where senior leaders must go down to local units and not just guide people, but actually learn from the people. Mm. And, you know, this is something that's enshrined in the DPRK. So they've always had this mass line. And I think, as you said, people in the DPRK, they feel that the socialist system is theirs, the country is theirs, you know. And to use a phrase that was once said to me in my old job, you know, they take ownership,
yes,
of the country. This was why the DPRK did not collapse when the other countries collapsed, because unfortunately, you know, in some of those other socialist countries, they were very bureaucratic, and people did not identify with the system in those countries and did not see it as their country. So this is the big difference between the DPRK and the revisionist countries of the past.
Yes, and it's that most crucial element here that was lacking in many of the countries that did collapse, which was that even though there was a good degree of support amongst the working class for The continuance of the system within the old USSR, the continuance of the socialist system, the leaders had escaped all control by the masses by that stage. They had become a law unto themselves, effectively. Whereas there's that, as you said, that mass line still is very strong within the DPRK and seems to be constantly reinforced every few years that this is the way things are done here, and this should not be deviated from, and also that the formulations of so-called bourgeois democracy are thoroughly rejected, and you have in the DPRK a system which seems to be a very real form of not only mass engagement of the population, but it's a genuine, I would call it a proletarian version of democracy. Would you say that that's an accurate label?
Yeah, I think very much so. It's proletarian democracy, it's people's democracy, it's the genuine democracy of the masses.
Yes.
Which exists in all levels of the DPRK, you know, right down to the People's Neighbourhood Unit, which is basically charged with running, you know, the blocks of flats.
Yeah, and that's the crucial thing about ownership there, Demet, because of course we hear a lot in the imperialist countries about you can own this, you can own that. Well, truth be told, the bank owns it most of the time. We don't own anything. But when you hear like bourgeois politicians wringing their hands about, oh my God, why are there all these riots in a place like France, for instance? And what it seems to me to boil down to is that the masses in those countries don't feel any ownership over anything because they don't have any control really over their lives. In any of the imperialist countries, you have fake democracy, fake elections, essentially, where, of course, you can vote for anybody, but the policy never changes. You compare that to the system in the DPRK, where, as you said, the masses are involved in the management of everything, right down to the status of their own housing and the management of their own communities. Nobody in the so-called Free West has any of those, any ability to influence their own conditions of housing, or very little. And yet, you know, we're subjected to the propaganda around the clock about democracy in the West. But in reality, there is none here. Whereas, like, if French society was a place where the masses felt genuine ownership, then there wouldn't be riots and people wouldn't be burning down their own neighborhoods, would they?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely correct. And as I've stressed once or twice in the recent past, you know, there's no riots in the DPRK. They're just unthinkable. And it just would not happen simply because people would not feel the need to do so. You know, the riots that are happening in France and, you know, which have happened in the UK in the past and might happen again, are basically expressions of the deep alienation that people actually feel. You know, they feel powerless, you know, they feel unable to change or improve their lives in any way.
Yes, and the supplementary question there was that because the role of the masses is so incredibly important, the DPRK, like many other socialist countries, but of course DPRK has lasted so much longer now, is the crucial role in the building of the system that education and the building of a national culture plays. And then just from researching into this episode that we're doing now and reading around some of the achievements of the DPRK, it seems that the educational level that's provided and that the masses can attain in the DPRK is incredibly impressive for a country that's, again, been under siege for so long. So can you talk a little bit about the emphasis on education there and the achievements, some of the achievements that have been attained by the DPRK in this field?
Well, the DPRK stresses education very strongly. And it's made very big achievements in education. In the DPRK, education up to all levels is free of charge, and that includes university. And as we know in the UK, it's actually very expensive to go to university in the UK. And not only do university students in the DPRK not pay tuition fees, but they get supplied with clothes free of charge, accommodation free of charge, very cheap food. And the DPRK's achievements are in the field of education are something incredible, because when Korea was liberated in 1945, in the northern part of Korea, there was not a single university. There's now, I think, I'll have to double check the figure, but I believe there's 300 universities in the DPRK. Certainly, there was certainly, you know, at the end of the 80s, there were about 200 universities in the DPRK. This is an incredibly high number. Pyongyang itself is a city of many universities, like Kim Il-sung University, Kim Chuk University, the University of National Economy, many other universities. It seems to me that each field of work in the DPRK has its own university. Like there is a University of Railways, for example, in the DPRK. I don't know in Britain if there's like an equivalent, or you know, where you've got a university just for the railway or transport industry. I'm sure there isn't. And I think this also is another important point, that it's vocational education. In DPRK, university study is integrated into society's needs. So when you take a course and graduate, you graduate into a job, rather than having a sort of academic qualification, which in capitalist countries often does not translate into a job.
No.
You know, I think that's a very big achievement. To say the number of universities is you know, absolutely phenomenal. And also, back in September 2012, the DPRK took the decision to move to 12-year basic education. You know, previously it had been 11-year basic education, you know, school education, I should say, you know, primary and secondary school. And so, you know, they extended the school age by 1 year. Again, quite a big step. And they are expanding the number of teacher training colleges. I've noticed this year that several new teacher training colleges have been opened. Even today, there was a new one opened. And back in 2019, I visited the Pyongyang Teacher Training College, which is a very, very modern institution. And they were using all sorts of educational techniques, like even virtual reality learning, which is, you know, it's quite staggering. You know, I think anyone who visited the DPRK would be extremely surprised.
Yes, and this flows into another question I was going to ask you, which is that you actually start looking at like what the DPRK is achieving today in terms of high technology, having a high technology sector in its economy, in terms of the level of self-reliance which has been achieved in the field of agriculture, which would be enviable to any country, to be honest. And it really does, it really is a question, a matter of like, it's night and day, the propaganda and the reality. The imperialist propaganda portrays this backward country that's always on the verge of falling apart. Then you look into it and you see actually the DPRK is advancing in all these high tech sectors, which we're told in Britain, well, the virtual reality is the future. And like you said, DPRK is achieving all this independently, and yet in Britain, try and get an IT problem fixed within a day. Capitalist efficiency is not the way it would seem, but it really does seem like the DPRK's achievements in going forward and like pushing towards like a more high tech economy are actually getting stronger as time goes on, despite all the difficulties, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. They are getting stronger, and I'm quite confident that despite the sanctions, they will emerge as an even more stronger and invincible socialist country.
Yeah, and I was watching recently. It was footage from I think it was a military parade from the DPRK. I believe it was later last year, and it was very impressive, obviously. But what struck me was like the military equipment that the armed forces have in the DPRK seemed ultra modern, and again, like a complete contradiction to the propaganda that the DPRK is still fighting with like AK-47s from the 1950s. Not that there's anything wrong with those; they proved more reliable than the American weapons in Vietnam, certainly. But the fact that the American imperialists can't just attack the DPRK without suffering significant damage themselves is certainly something which is a big constraint on imperialism, which is why it seems that they want to get their South Korean, I think it's fair to say it's a puppet regime, to do most of the provocations and therefore the fighting for them, don't they? They seem to be perfectly willing to sacrifice the South Koreans to try and just damage the DPRK in some way.
Yeah, that is very much the case. They would not hesitate to sacrifice their South Korean puppets in a war against the DPRK, and South Korea is a puppet regime, and this is the fate of puppet regimes everywhere. They will be sacrificed for their masters. That's a fact. It was like years ago, the US backed Taiwan. That was a puppet of the US against the People's Republic of China, and then they recognized the People's Republic of China, and Taiwan was virtually thrown away.
Yeah.
And they see all their puppet regimes as disposable, and it is very much the case with South Korea. And of course, DPRK military technology is advancing by leaps and bounds, particularly in the field of missile technology, where they've in the past year, they've successfully tested the new type of intercontinental ballistic missile, the Hwasong-Pho 17 and the Hwasong-Pho 18. Those have both been tested. Those missiles can reach the US mainland. This is a big achievement. And as you said, the prey, military prey, is very impressive. And there's been new kinds of tanks, and all this is made in the DPRK. They're not reliant on another country for it. And the sanctions have absolutely no effect on the DPRK's military technology. And there's myths spread about sanctions breaking. But in truth, the real power is self-reliance.
Yes, I wanted to just turn in our final section of this interview towards the question of the two Koreas, one occupied and dominated by US imperialism, and one that is, again, to quote John Major, truly sovereign. When it comes to Southern Korea, the so-called Republic of Korea, well, we're sold that in the propaganda of the imperialists as this, oh, well, that's the independent one. But the reality is that This is a country which has been occupied by the US imperialists for over 70 years. And that also has had a devastating impact on the national culture of the southern part of Korea, and the way in which that state hyper-exploits the Korean working class to the point where they're imposing or trying to impose 60-hour weeks. You have what appears to be a completely obnoxious and degenerate national culture, which is informed by all the worst aspects of US imperialism. Whereas in the DPRK, it seems from everything that you've been saying, you have this culture that emphasizes the direct involvement of the masses in the state, the direct involvement of the masses in the running of the economy, the attaining a very high level of education and culture for the masses. Whereas in the South, it seems that it's the lowest level of culture possible for the masses is what is shoved onto them. And I correct me if I'm wrong about this, but isn't it the case that the birth rate in the South has now reached into the negative? So look, like literally the population will be shrinking in times to come. So it seems that what you have in the South is actually, in actual fact, a growing US-sponsored nightmare for the people there.
Yeah, I mean, that is indeed correct. It sums it up. Yes, South Korea has a declining birth rate, basically because no one can afford to bring up children in South Korea because of the massive expenses of bringing up a child in South Korea, having to pay for education, having to pay for childcare, having to pay for health treatment. And also because people don't want to produce children in a society like South Korea, which is an awful society. It has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, the longest working hours in the world. There is a massive gulf between the rich and poor in South Korea. And even a South Korean film, which I believe was called The Parasite, exposed there is a very big gap between the rich and poor in South Korea, which, the mainstream media try to hide these facts from people, or, from time to time, something about South Korea slips out. They might report it, but generally, they get given quite a free ride in the mainstream media. In fact, not just a free ride, but often they are eulogized, as high growth, quote unquote, and or as a liberal human rights paradise when it's nothing like that. And of course, South Korea over the years has conducted its sort of own whitewashing campaign, its own propaganda campaign. I mean, this goes back to the 80s, possibly even before, when they gave teaching positions to certain middle-class liberal academics from the UK and from the US and some European countries, and had them write sort of propaganda eulogies to South Korea. But the reality is it is a horrendous place where people live lives below human standards. And national culture in South Korea has been destroyed. It's been obliterated. I've seen pictures of South Korea where a lot of the signage is in English. The Korean language in South Korea is debased. There's a lot of foreign words used, English, Japanese, Chinese, and so on. And as you say, South Korean culture is absolutely abysmal. Whereas in the DPRK, you've actually got strong national culture.
Yes.
So, you know, I think this sort of graphically shows the difference between the two systems.
Yes, exactly. And just to conclude, Dermot, the DPRK's view on reunification, I remember a quote from Kim Il-sung, which I can't remember the exact phrasing, but he said it didn't matter if it took hundreds of years, that reunification and true sovereignty would be achieved. So how is the DPRK government viewing the potential for reunification at the moment? This is obviously still a name that they have, but they are faced with a particularly belligerent and aggressive US imperialists and of course a South Korean puppet leader at the moment who's even more of a doormat than his predecessor was. So how are they viewing the potential for reunification at the moment, and with what potential do you think there is in the near future for that, barring of course a potential revolution in South Korea itself?
Right. Well, the DPRK is committed to the independent and peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula. In the past, it has put forward many realistic proposals for the reunification of Korea. But as you say, all this has been frustrated by different puppet regimes in the US. And the present puppet regime, it looks like one of the worst for a long time. You know, there was this awful spectacle of the puppet ruler of South Korea actually singing American Pie in front of Biden, you know, more embarrassing and cringeworthy. Puppet ruling clique doesn't decide history. There's massive opposition to the puppet regime in the South. Struggles are taking place all the time. You know, there's protests by the trade unions in South Korea. Of course, there's been a lot of repression this year. Four trade union leaders were arrested in South Korea on charges that they were spying for the DPRK, quote unquote. And I think also members of other organizations also had the same charge leveled at them. But there is quite a strong struggle of the South Korean people against the puppet regime and for the withdrawal of US troops and bases in South Korea. South Korean people do not accept the occupation of South Korea by the US. And in the past, US cultural centers in South Korea have actually been burnt down. I believe some shops or restaurants won't serve Americans in South Korea. So there is quite a strong anti-US sentiment and the sentiment for reunification. And one day this struggle will be successful. You know, we don't know when. History is on the side of progress, not on the side of the South Korean puppets. And also, you've got a pro-DPRK underground in South Korea. You have the anti-imperialist National Democratic Front of South Korea, which is an underground underground organization, but that's guided by the Juche idea, and that struggles for the reunification of Korea. So, you know, as you say, it's something that will not probably happen instantly, but I'm quite confident that one day the South Korean puppet regime will be overthrown. The US troops will be expelled from Korea and that reunification will take place.
All right, that's an excellent place to conclude our discussion today, Dermot. Before we finally wrap up, though, if people want to learn more about the DPRK, about KFA, where can they go on the internet to find out more about both of these things?
Right. We've got a number of websites which you can find easily. The International KFA website is simply www.korea-dpr.com, or you've also got our own kfauk.com. I've got my own blog, Anglo People's Korea. We're on Facebook, but Facebook did take down our original page, which had 12,000 followers, but we've got a new page. You can easily find it. Just put Korean Friendship Association UK. That'd take you to the new page. We don't know how long that will last. We're on Twitter. You can find us easily on Twitter, KFA UK on Twitter. We've also got a Telegram channel, which is good because it's not subjected to censorship like Facebook, and we don't have to worry about the Telegram channel being taken down. And recently, a young member of KFA UK has also started an Instagram channel, and there's even Reddit and Discord. We're quite well represented on the internet.
Oh, excellent. So be sure to check those out. We'll link to them in the description of the episode when we put this out. So until next time, though, Dermot Hudson of the Korea Friendship Association, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for your interviewing me. I think it's been a great interview. Some very good questions.